Running a Shopify store and drowning in shipping chaos? ShipStation can fix this for you. ShipStation goes beyond just shipping labels with advanced automation, batch processing, and shipping discounts that a single platform just doesn't offer. Like discounts up to 90% off major carriers. See how ShipStation can make shipping for your Shopify store better. Go to ShipStation.com and access all features free for 30 days. No credit card or contract required. Cancel anytime. That's ShipStation.com.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
I'm Larry O'Connor alongside Brian Wilson.
And joining us on the line right now, Ambassador John Bolton, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, good friend of this program. Ambassador Bolton, good morning to you.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
All right. Look, I want to start out by looking back at the president's recent trip to Japan, and more importantly, his stop in Hiroshima, in which he said the following.
We may not be able to eliminate man's capacity to do evil, so nations and the alliances that we formed must possess the means to defend ourselves. But among those nations like my own that hold nuclear stockpiles, we must have the courage to escape the logic of fear and pursue a world without them.
And he went a step further, adding,
the scientific revolution that led to the splitting of an atom requires a moral revolution as well. That is why we come to this place.
So I'd like your thoughts on this. Is it time for us to reduce our nuclear stockpile, do away with nuclear weapons? And what about his suggestion that having such weapons is an immoral choice?
Right. Well, you know, the idea that we eliminate our weapons and that everybody else eliminates their nuclear weapons and peace breaks out is just typical of the kind of Obama thinking that shows he lives on a different planet. I mean, even if you could eliminate all nuclear weapons, what about then the chemical weapons, the biological weapons? Indeed, with respect to some countries, we've made it clear if they used chemical weapons first, we would retaliate with nuclear weapons. And we should have that option because it creates deterrence that hopefully prevents the use of any kind of weapon. It's really the second point, though, that I think is the most important. And I took that to be Obama never used the words "I apologize," but I took that to be the kind of criticism of Harry Truman that was pretty close to an apology. That Truman was there, we had overcome the technological difficulties, we had the atom bomb, but poor Harry Truman just didn't measure up to Barack, high-minded Obama's standards, and he didn't have the moral revolution that has emerged from Barack Obama, and he used the weapon. I mean, it was. I just think it shows Obama didn't have the slightest idea of what Truman confronted when he made the decision to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and then on Nagasaki. Winston Churchill, I know he doesn't pay much attention to Winston Churchill, but Winston Churchill had said that the invasion and conquest of the Japanese home islands would have required, this is Churchill's phrase, effusions of American blood. Effusions of American blood. Yeah. So Harry Truman, confronted with that choice, I think did the right thing militarily, and he did the right thing morally in dropping the bomb.
Yeah, and you did. It's hard not to infer from the president's statements that in some way he has a morally superior view of these things that those Neanderthal American presidents like Franklin Roosevelt and Truman just couldn't grasp. Frankly, I think it's worse than an apology.
Well, I think his narcissism really is quite exceptional, and I just thought it was interesting. He went to Japan ostensibly for a G7 meeting. He obviously took the opportunity to go to Hiroshima. You go all the way out to East Asia. Typically, a president will go to a couple of other countries. Obama picked one other country, Vietnam, just coincidentally another country we had a war with.
Right.
So he's now concluded the Asia swing of his apology tour, and who knows where he goes next, except maybe North Korea is yet to come.
Yeah, we need T-shirts for the Obama apology tour 2016. Yeah. Ambassador Bolton, I would love for you to chime in on something that has been driving me insane in light of the Inspector General's report out of the State Department about Hillary Clinton's use of email. The Clinton campaign and some other apologists with a D after their name on Capitol Hill keep calling out Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, in some way saying that they had an equivalent policy. Now, you worked at the State Department with both of those individuals. Can you please settle this once and for all? Is there any comparison at all between Powell Rice and their emails versus Hillary Clinton?
Well, certainly not with Condi Rice. She didn't use email that much. I don't ever recall exchanging emails with her. And frankly, with both Powell and Rice, almost all of our interactions were over the phone or in person. And it wasn't, you know, we weren't into the email era the way we are and have been since then. But I will say this, Colin Powell once told me he used his AOL account to deal with subjects that were before him as Secretary of State. And I was concerned about it at the time. I said, how can you guarantee that people aren't reading it? And he wasn't that concerned about it. Now, I think there's a vast difference between what he did and what Hillary Clinton did. But I watched some of those Democrats. I watched Adam Schiff with Chris Wallace, who took him apart limb by limb. I don't think this is a partisan issue. Look, if the statute of limitations hasn't run, if Powell did things that were comparable to what Hillary Clinton did, he should be investigated. This is serious business. It's not a partisan issue. And, you know, the inspector general laid it all out. The FBI can look at it now. As I say, the statute of limitations may be run. But this is not a question of defend the person with the R behind his name and hang the D out to dry. It's a question of American national security.
All right. So speaking of North Koreans, you mentioned a moment ago, they did another launch that apparently failed. But again, they continue to be problematic in the region. Your thoughts? What should we be doing as a nation about North Korea? Should we ignore them? Should we engage with them? Should we, you know, start to think about, you know, a nuclearized North Korea that's a bigger threat because they have missiles that could deliver those nuclear weapons?
Right. No, I think we need to worry about it very seriously, which is something that I don't think Obama's done for the last 7 years. And I understand they've now had a string of test launch failures. But I remember when I was a boy watching Jupiter C's blow up and Vanguard missiles collapse on the launch pad. Our rocket scientists
back then.
Yeah,
we had trouble too. Yeah, that's right.
Our rocket scientists back then said, well, that launch, which ended up in the rocket collapsing into itself, was a 90% success. And they justified that on the basis they had learned where their failures were. So presumably the North Koreans can learn too, and obviously they would prefer to have successful launches. But this is part of the process of getting to a point where they have deliverable nuclear weapons. And we have both the South Korean military and the commander of U.S. forces in South Korea saying that the North Koreans really are making rapid progress to miniaturize their nuclear devices and to have ballistic missile capability to put a target on the west coast of the United States in the near future. So the longer we ignore them, the longer we don't find a solution, the greater the risk to us, especially since Obama has gutted our national missile defense program. I think the long-term answer is that we have to persuade China to allow the two Koreas to be reunified. I think that's the only really long-term solution. China has a unique influence over North Korea. It could make that happen, but we're not talking to them about that.
Ambassador John Bolton, we're going to have to leave it there, but it's great
Thank
to have you.
You.
By the way, you look great out there on your hog at Rolling Thunder yesterday.
In my seersucker suit. You saw me then.
Well, I saw someone with an epic mustache. I assumed it was you, but definitely was not wearing a seersucker suit. So
there are a lot of guys out there like that.
Maybe so.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
I'm Brian Wilson alongside Larry O'Connor.
Yeah! Woo. I wonder if this is the fight song over at Duke Ellington High School. It should be. Love Sir Duke. Although, since Duke Ellington High School is actually a performing arts venue, I doubt they have a fight song for their non-existent football team. But that being said, there are much bigger problems over at that high school, as been revealed by an audit recently conducted by our guest, DC Auditor Kathy Patterson. And we're so happy that she joins us now. Thanks for coming.
Good morning.
So the renovation of Duke Ellington School for the Arts in Georgetown was originally budgeted and passed and approved for $71 million. And your audit now has discovered that this project is up to $178 million, and it could be growing, right?
Absolutely. We still don't know what the final number is going to be. But this is, it's actually not unusual in terms of our school modernization program. A lot of the schools have seen that kind of growth because basically we're sort of putting shovels in the ground before we finish the planning. And so everything seems to be going up along the way without knowing at the front end what you're going to be spending.
Now, yeah, I've never worked in government, so you'll have to help me out with this. But in the private sector, if you embark on a project and you don't know how much something's going to cost, you don't approve the cost. You actually get a budget that's much more feasible. And when you have these kind of overruns, heads start to roll. How did this happen and whose heads are rolling?
Well, if no one's heads are rolling just yet, but if you and I sat down to plan how we would do school modernization and we said, let's spend as much as we possibly can, that's sort of the process we have in place. And we have some fabulous new schools. But the question becomes, is what we're spending today going to preclude finishing the job? And that's what's kind of a concern. I mean, Duke Ellington will be a wonderful new school. It will serve the performing arts students very, very well. But it becomes a question of how are we sort of having discipline over the public tax dollars we're spending.
Do you happen to know how many square feet this project is? Because when you build something, you figure out the cost per square foot.
Well, it's going to be a very, very high per square foot figure. And one of the things we showed in our report that came out last summer was on some of the high schools we looked at, they were well over what was in the planning document.
But do you actually have the number of how many square feet are in this project?
It's in our report. It's well over 100,000. I can pull that out for you.
Right.
I don't happen to remember it off the top of my head. There are a couple of numbers that are important, though, the per square foot cost, but also the per square foot per student, which is over 400 square feet per student, because in this new large facility, we're going to be serving 600 performing arts students, and it's an important priority for the city.
And I understand it is a performing arts school, and therefore the needs and the design of the school are different than your traditional school. I get all that. But I'm reading reports all around the place here where you can build a pretty good-sized high school, 151,000 square feet, for example, and it comes in at about 300 square feet, $300 per square foot.
Right.
And you're already talking about, being somewhere in the neighborhood of $400
per
square foot.
Well, $424 per square foot, and it's 167,000 square feet.
167,000 square feet. Well, it seems like we could do that for a lot less than 100, the amount of money that has been laid out here.
We probably could, but again, sort of trying to bring discipline to cost has not been the priority. The priority has been design, has been making each of our high schools iconic, meeting the requests of the community. What's interesting about Duke Ellington is it will be serving performing arts students, but there will be a lot of the space empty during parts of the day. And one of our recommendations is to have DCPS work with the high school to figure out maybe there's some other alternative uses for that space when the performing arts students aren't, in fact, not using the space, so that we can, have some additional value for the dollars that we're expending. That's one of our recommendations.
You're talking about the school modernization program, and that's what's at play here at Duke Ellington. But as you mentioned, this is going on in other parts of the district. And frankly, it's going on in other parts of the Washington metro area. Would it not have been cheaper to tear down the old school and just build a new school from scratch?
Absolutely, would have been cheaper. But the building that was Western High School is historic. It's on both the federal and the local lists of historic places. So tearing down the facade would not have been probably very feasible. We do note that a couple of other locations were looked at for the new high school. One, the current Logan School near Union Station, another a field west of where the Ellington School is today. And both of those sites were not chosen for different reasons.
Mm.
So there are other ways to sort of bring down the cost. But one of the points we're trying to make is that all the policymakers need to make these decisions in a concerted, planful way before shovels go in the ground.
Should somebody be fired as a result of this?
Well, one of the things, I don't know that anyone will be fired.
Is that a problem that somebody's not going to be fired after going over $100 million?
Well, you'd have to go back into previous administrations for the way this process was set up, and I think a lot of those people aren't there now. But what DGS, the Department of General Services, is doing now is building in some more internal capacity to watch over the kinds of planning and to watch over some of the processes going forward. So that's at least a hopeful sign. And again, I want to be clear, it's not that this is this may not be too much money, but to do it in such a piecemeal way doesn't permit a thorough vetting of what you're spending as you go along.
And that leads me to my next question. Again, I'm looking at this through the perspective of what happens in the real world, in the private sector. Well, when did this project begin, when it was first approved for $71 million?
It was first approved for $71 million in the FY12 capital improvement plan.
So at some point over the last 4 years, as this project went on, clearly people knew, oh, my gosh, we're going over. In fact, we're going to go double what was originally budgeted. At what point do things stop and they go back and they say, hey, guys, we need more money, or maybe we need to rethink this entire project? Is that built into the program?
It's only built in at a certain point when there's some value engineering. Typically, it's when you hire the contractor. And again, the way we do it, we plan a building, we hire an architect, we have all the designs, we work with the community, and then we hire a builder, and the builder says, look, guys, this is going to cost twice what you think it is. And at that point, everybody is bought into what we're doing. And so to say, no, we're going to, like, scale back, we're going to do half what we all agreed we would do, that's where you leave the community and where you leave folks like council members. It's not a good way to do business.
That just takes political will. I mean, look at the Purple
Line.
The Purple Line was approved for a certain amount of money, but the final money was never allocated until Governor Hogan came in. Governor Hogan came in and said, no, we're not going to spend that kind of money. If we're going to do the Purple Line, here's how we'll do it. And guess what? Everyone's on board now. So there's just no political will to say, nope, we don't want to spend that money because it's not their money.
Well, and again,
that was a statement, not a question, but I just thought I'd vent at you.
But if we drew a line in the sand today and said, okay, for the 25 additional schools we need to fix in our public school system, we're going to do that differently. I think that would make sense. Not that we're not going to build fabulous schools, but let's build them in a at least a cost-conscious kind of way. Schools that also have some cost discipline.
Is that idea actually receiving some, you know, warm and fuzzies from the D.C. Council, or are you getting pushback?
Well, the fact that eventually we will run out of money, eventually we will hit our debt cap, that is, I hope, bringing a little bit more discipline.
Oh, I don't know. Have you seen Metro lately? Kathy Patterson, we appreciate the work that you're doing.
Yeah,
and if
thanks,
you need
Kathy.
To get the word out about these things, let us know, because they listen. We have
Thank
that.
You.
Thank
right,
you.
So.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. The best of Mornings on the Mall.
All right, this is the weekend that WMATA starts to fix itself, or at least they're going to start trying to fix themselves. And what better day than to have Chris Barnes with Fix WMATA on to talk about this rather impressive project that the Metro system is undergoing starting this weekend. Hello, Chris. Good morning to you.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Oh, we're doing really well. Glad you could join us. Listen, I have a feeling that people are not prepared for this. I have a sense that this is going to be a bigger mess than people understand, and that even though we have done our best to try to get people aware of these changes that are coming to Metro, the true impact of it is not quite understood. What's your sense of it?
Well, I think you're probably right for the first surge, and that's what they're calling them, the surges. The first one starts on June 3rd and affects the Silver and Orange line between Boston and East Falls Church. And I think that's going to be the rude awakening that the region sees. Riders may not completely understand the impact of 18-minute headways and single tracking during rush hours will have. But I'll tell you, after surge number one, I think the region will be more readily adaptable to what's about to come for the next year. At least I hope so.
So what should WMATA and Metro, what should they be communicating to riders right now that they're not, so that the riders can be prepared for this?
Well, I think, first of all, they need to open a channel of communication. There's been a lot of one-way communication. I've seen flyers being handed out. I've seen some signs going up. But as far as, like, social media communication, I don't see that channel. You know, when we had Metro Forward, which was a five-year, $5 billion rebuilding program, they created a Twitter account, they created YouTube videos, they created a Facebook account. There was all this outreach for two-way communication with riders to answer questions. I'm not seeing that this time. It's more of a one-way communication. And I'm worried that's cutting off, you know, people's ability to ask these important questions, like how do I get around?
Let me ask you, we recently saw in Metro sort of the firing of a lot of key managers. Now,
20 of them.
Yeah, that was big stuff. And a lot of them were senior people. And when you lose senior people sometimes, I mean, listen, I think it did happen, don't get me wrong. When you lose senior people, you lose institutional knowledge. Is there any concern about that?
Well, yes, but unfortunately, I don't know if that's a problem. you know, these are folks who have years and years and years, maybe decades, of information and knowledge about WMATA. Well, maybe that's the problem. Maybe we need people who have come from agencies that are doing better to come in and provide a new perspective on how to get things fixed.
I mean, if the institutional knowledge is flawed, it's not very helpful, is what you're saying.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I'll say Congress has called them Deadwood. They've used some other names for some of the folks at Metro who probably should have been gone years ago, so we can bring in new talent to get things fixed. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing from Mr. Wiedefeld and Mr. Evans, is this surge to try to get things fixed with new ways.
Has there been any sort of disclosure about what exactly these managers did to warrant them losing their jobs?
No, I haven't seen names. I haven't heard justification. I did hear a report that this was less of you're fired and more of, hey, we're offering you an early retirement.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it may have been a combination of both of those things, but I haven't seen, you know, lists of names or anything yet.
Oh, that's it. I had not heard that yet, Chris. Thank you, because early retirement is a whole lot different than you're fired.
Yeah.
Right.
Seems like, I mean, even though those are personal matters, that they ought to be able to get at that because it's a public entity, right?
Right. Well, I have no doubt that, you know, TARPs, which is like Freedom of Information Acts for WMATA, have been filed. I'm sure the media is looking into that. At least I certainly hope so. But we know, for example, the former head of the ROCC, Hercules Ballard, isn't gone. He's on extended leave. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's still people are still getting paid. They're just not doing their job anymore.
Can I ask you about the rise in crime that we've seen lately? Specifically, we learned of this sexual assault that occurred on the Red Line a month ago, but it seemed to have been, you know, sort of swept under the rug for a while. And then there's been some other incidents recently. Whose jurisdiction does that fall under, and how does Metro respond to these safety issues?
Yeah, this is an area where you'll get me infuriated. This lies squarely on Metro and squarely on Ron Pavlik, who is the chief of the Metro Transit Police Department. They have got to step up. They've got to be more responsive. They've got to be more visible. Wiedefeld asked them to start telling us, in the wake of the rape on the Red Line, start telling riders when something like that happens. You know, it was a month before we found out about it. Well, I've seen examples on Twitter since then of things happening, and they're still not telling us. So this lies squarely on Metro Transit Police to step up to the plate.
It's insane. Right. Yeah. Absolutely insane. We're glad you're watching.
We're glad you're watching for us there, Chris. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, guys. Anytime.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Now, more of the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Is it the policy of the State Department where the preservation of the secrecy of secret negotiations is concerned to lie in order to achieve that goal?
James, I think there are times where diplomacy needs privacy in order to progress. This is a good example of that.
Well, that was the clip that has caused a firestorm over at the State Department. It's because, you know, James Rosen was doing a story about all of the Iranian negotiations. Goes back to look for that clip on the State Department website, found that it was missing. It had been excised. And at first they said it was just a glitch. And then yesterday they admitted that it was more than a glitch, that somebody actually called up and requested that. Joining us here now to talk about this further is James Rosen from your Fox News channel. James Rosen, of course, he's a music aficionado. He's the chief Washington correspondent of Fox News, the author of Cheney One-on-One, a man, a bon vivant around town, and a good friend of this program. Hello, James. You're stirring it up over there, aren't you, buddy? Aren't you? You got all kinds of stuff going on over there that, at the State Department, calling them out. What is the latest in this story?
Well, good to be with you guys. We'll see what the latest is. I have the feeling we're not done with the story and that it might take any number of turns from here. But what you have in essence, guys, is very extraordinary. You have the fact that a lie was told to me by a State Department spokesperson from the podium with respect to the Iran nuclear talks. And about 10 months later, I returned to the State Department briefing to sort of cross-examine the successor's spokesperson about that lie. And that person basically admits that the lie occurred. That's Jen Psaki. Then there's an attempt that very day, we've now learned, to cover up the admission of Jen Psaki, that Jen Psaki had made, of the previous person's lie, with a white flash that we don't know who ordered that. And when this act of evidence tampering was discovered by me and my producer, Garen Hayes, there was what some might consider an attempt to cover up the cover-up of the lie by simply describing it as a glitch and not a deliberate deletion. And then finally, there was an investigation of all of this, an admission that pretty much all of the foregoing is true by Admiral Kirby, who's a stand-up guy for doing that. The irony here is that the exchange between Jen Psaki and me that you played, rather than disappearing from the memory hole as whoever intended it to occur, has ensured that, in fact, it went viral and has been played countless more times than it would have been. This doesn't happen often, all of this sort of thing, in the modern presidency, where you have someone like Admiral Kirby stand at a podium and admit to this kind of assault on history and memory. And so I'm grateful to play some small role in holding people to account, our public officials. But there's a lot of people who think that there's still more discovery and disclosure that's yet to be had here with respect to this whole case.
Yeah, I think anybody who can think critically knows that there's more to be discussed here, James. And I wonder, you're pretty familiar with the comings and goings of the Communications Department at the State Department. Can you imagine there being a protocol in place where an edit like this can be ordered without, A, some sort of paper trail or some sort of written request or demand, and B, the fact that this person says they can't remember who told them to do it. How many people at the State Department could have the authority to order something like this? It should be pretty easy to figure out.
Well, first, as a matter of basic human memory, if you're able to recall 3 years later being on the receiving end of what you regard as a remarkable order like this, such that you remember it, it seems to me logical that you would also remember who was responsible for issuing
it. It sure does, doesn't it? Yeah.
But beyond that, Admiral Kirby in the briefing stated that one of the reasons he's not proceeding further with the case is that there were, at the time the deletion was made, no procedures or protocols in place that would have made such an act a violation of anything. And so
are you telling me that, now, James, does that mean that it was permitted?
Well, it's akin to saying that it was permitted.
That seems to be running rampant at Foggy Bottom.
And that too has come under some challenge, with some people citing the Federal Records Act, and I have people tweeting me with links to various statutes. So again, I think that there's any number of interested parties in Washington who might see fit to be following up on this. And that may well occur.
Now, I guess I have to ask you, who would benefit from having that clip, that 8-minute clip, excised from the record? Jen Psaki, it seems, might benefit from that, but she has gone on record as saying, oh, it wasn't me, I didn't make that call.
Right, and I appreciate her volunteering that statement. You know, when you're not going to purge the accompanying transcript from your website,
yeah.
Right? It's not, therefore, a full-throated effort at censorship. So no one would really benefit. I mean, the inanity of the entire act is apparent to all, Brian. The idea that you can simply erase 8 minutes from a video briefing that
as if it didn't occur, that's right.
That was recorded by the pool for the TV networks as well. And frankly, the exact exchange with Jen Psaki that you played at the outset of our segment, I used in my special report with Brett Baer's story that very night. So it's in our video bank as well. So it was a peculiar and quixotic act, but one with some dark undertones to it. And last night I was on the Special Report Online panel, which had the honor of sitting alongside Charles Krauthammer, Chuck Lane, Tucker Carlson, and of course Bret Baier. And Charles Krauthammer said that this was Kafkaesque. And I interrupted him and said, Charles, it has been an aspiration of mine since childhood, peculiar as it may be, to find myself at the center of a Kafkaesque experience. So thank you for that. And then somebody else said that it was more Orwellian than Kafkaesque, and I said, perhaps Hitchcockian, at which point Tucker Carlson said, we can all agree, mid-century dark.
Well, thankfully, James Rosen, you get to have a Kafkaesque experience without turning into a giant cockroach. And I think we can all be thankful
Charles,
for that.
Charles, in fact, suggested that might happen the very next day. I'm pleased to report to you live on the air. It has not yet occurred.
Good to know.
Very quickly, Ben Rhodes, would you consider him a prime suspect in this excising?
I don't know. I think Admiral Kirby in the briefing yesterday averred to this having originated within the public affairs department, which he heads, the Bureau of Public Affairs at the State Department. That is a limited number of people. The fact that the person who received the order is not of a mind to be able to remember it suggests that potentially the person issuing the order might still be in a position of authority.
All right.
But we don't know.
Well, we'll sure to follow what you dig up here, James.
Stay on it.
By the way, real fast, it's my understanding that you were very upset that Brian and I critiqued the brand new Monkees album on Monday, and you weren't a participant in that. So have you had a chance to listen to the fab, well, there's only three of them left. Did you hear the new album, and do you have any opinion on it?
Larry, you didn't just use the term fab.
Well, only because you're our Beatles expert, and I know that you're conjoining the two here because you like the Monkees as well.
No, there is no conjoinment.
All right.
But I have heard of two tracks from the new Monkees album, and, you know, it's interesting to hear that voice again. You know, it's always just, it's sort of a great time machine to hear Mickey Dolenz sing.
Yeah.
But the way they sort of attempt to kind of recreate the jingly, jangly sounds of the 60s is, I don't know, there's something unartistic about that.
All right.
Well,
I hate to end on such a sour note.
Well,
a sour note. I get what you did there. That's okay. Mickey Dolenz, he's got a lovely pop voice, and we'll hear a little bit more of it.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave that pop culture discussion for another time. Thanks so much, James.
Thank you, guys.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Well, here's something weird. President Barack Obama, he's one of the most intelligent and eloquent presidents that we have ever, as an American people, have had the luck, grace, and good fortune to have as our chief executive. I think everyone would agree on that. He's the greatest speaker of all time. And yet yesterday in Indiana, he was delivering remarks, and apparently either the teleprompter went on the fritz or his brain went on the fritz. Listen to this.
If we turn against each other based on divisions of race or religion, if we fall for, you know, a bunch of okey-doke,
that's eloquent
just
right there.
Just because it sounds funny or the tweets are provocative.
Ladies and gentlemen,
how long did that go on?
President Max Headroom right there in Indiana.
This is Max Headroom.
Whoa.
That sounded like Porky Pig there.
Now, huge kudos, by the way, to Jim Hoft over at Gateway Pundit, who grabbed this and provided us with a painstakingly crafted transcript. The president said, if we turn against each other based on division of race or religion, if we fall for... you know, a bunch of okie doke. Okie doke, by the way.
What does that mean?
That is some incredible vocabulary there. All right, now I've done a lot of research on this, knowing that we were going to talk about it.
Right.
And believe it or not, I am not kidding now. This was raised back in 2011. Apparently, the president was doing a lot of stammering. You also notice when he doesn't speak with a teleprompter in prepared remarks, beautifully crafted prepared remarks, I might have, you know, soaring rhetoric. Yeah. He often throws a lot of uhs in there. We've noticed the uhs before, right? We talk about the uhs. Well,
But that was true for the.
Which is fine. Well, hold on a second.
We had a severe outbreak last night. It was at least stage three, Romnish.
In fact, listen to this one. This was a while back.
Obviously.
That was when he was talking about the Redskins name, right? Well, listen, this was raised back in 2011. A woman named Megan Daum wrote in at the LA Times and explained the stutter. I'm not kidding you. Listen to this. It's not that Obama can't speak clearly. It's that he employs the intellectual stammer. That's what it's called. Not to be confused with a stutter, which the president decidedly does not have. No, the intellectual stammer signals a brain that is moving so fast that the mouth can't keep up.
I'm going to remember that.
So what you're hearing here is actually the brilliance of Barack Obama.
If we fall for, you know, a bunch of okie doke, just because it sounds funny or the tweets are provocative, then we're not going to build on the progress that we've started.
He is so smart that his own brain can't keep up. No, his own mouth can't keep up with his brain.
Brain moves faster than his mouth.
That is what's really happening here. So don't worry, everybody. He's still just as brilliant as you always thought. It's 7:50 on WMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMM
listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Listen Monday through Friday, 5 to 9 a.m. to hear the show live on 105.9 FM WMAL.